Hello, Central. This is Chuck Shaden on Those Were the Days, calling Rudy Valley in Hollywood. Are you there, Mr. Valley?
Yes, I'm right here ready to talk with you.
How are you today?
Fairly well, thank you.
Great. I'm calling for a great many of your fans in the Chicago area who are looking forward to seeing you in person here next October.
You mean both of them?
Both of them? No, several thousand of them out here in the Chicago area. You're going to be at the Airy Crown Theater at McCormick Place, is that right?
I am on the night of October 9th.
October 9th. Well, we'll be looking forward to seeing you there.
I'm also making a TV appearance the night before.
Are you? Where can we see you then?
What is your TV man that has a night show there in town?
Howard Miller.
I think that's it. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. That's on Channel 7.
I think I'm on that show on the night of the 8th.
Well, great. We'll look forward to seeing you there, too.
Right.
But better yet, we'd be out at the McCormick Place to see you in person.
Yes, I'll probably emcee the show and do my own little spot as I did last week at the St. Louis Muni Opera.
Uh-huh. Have you been doing this sort of thing regularly lately?
No, but last week we opened up August 30th at the St. Louis Muni. They have an audience out and you open up some 12,000 persons with Dennis Day, Don Ameche, Dorothy Lamour, and Betty Grable. And, of course, a tremendous company of real fine singers and a lot of kids. The dancing and the singing is quite a week.
I can imagine it was.
Yeah.
Say, can we ask a little bit about your fantastic career? When was it when you organized the Connecticut Yankees?
I put the little band together in New York on the night of January 8th, 1928.
Uh-huh. Was that at the Hi-Ho Club?
That is exactly where it was. There were two boys from New Haven. They were not Yale men. They were just New Haven boys.
Uh-huh.
Janice and a tenor sax. The other boys were New Yorkers. There were seven and myself, making eight total.
And you were the leader and the main singer with the band.
The
saxophonist.
Lacking brass, we could not play the stock arrangements of the day, so all we played was choruses,
uh-huh.
Which was very different from the average band who always played the stock arrangements. And here, for the first time, the jaded radio listener tunes in and hears an orchestra playing nothing but very soft music, since there was no brass and only choruses. And choruses of songs I'd ever heard before, songs I'd found in England in 1924 and 25.
Uh-huh. The Hi-Ho Club been doing many remote broadcasts before Rudy Valley got there?
Didn't do any at all. It only opened on January 1st, 1928.
Oh.
And they didn't like the band that opened it, so they fired them, and that's where I came into the picture. Happened to bump into a guy that knew about the job, and I said I'd take the job only if I could lead the band. He said, "You've got it."
Uh-huh.
And I led it for, as I say, from January 8th and on, and by the end of middle of February, I think, somebody talked to WABC, which was then the Atlantic Broadcasting Company, setting Greeby radios, and it later on became the flagship of the Columbia Broadcasting System. Paley maintains that it was even 1927 the flagship of CBS, but it wasn't. I know that when I went on it, it was called the Atlantic Broadcasting Company in Steinway Hall, offices in Steinway Hall, selling Greeby radios, which is a radio of that day.
I see. When did you leave the Hi-Ho Club for your first radio broadcast?
The Hi-Ho Club in the fall of 1929.
Uh-huh. Was that when you went on the air with the with Villa Valley?
28.
Was that when you went on the air with Villa Valley?
No, I didn't go on the air with Villa Valley. We were thrown out of the Hi-Ho Club in an effort. There's a little bit of strategy on the part of the maitre d' and the man who owned the band for whom I worked to get me out of there and sell us to another place where we could get more money.
Uh-huh.
I was not a part of the deal. I didn't know what was going on. I only knew that suddenly the band and I were asked, and we were packing the place. So we had nowhere to go, and I had heard that the room at 1060s, which is today the Copacabana, the famed Copacabana,
yes,
was then called Versailles, not to be confused with the Versailles of 50th Street that Nick Prunus opened later on over near Lexington Avenue and 3rd.
Uh-huh.
Park Avenue, rather. That Versailles didn't come into being until much later on in the late 40s, but in 1928 and 29, 1060 downstairs was known as Versailles. They had hollowed out all the rock of this basement and made it into a very lovely room owned by a scoundrel named Bellack, B-E-L-L-A-K.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that they were having maybe three or four persons a night. There's a very fine little band, small five-piece band, Eddie Davis, And Walter Gross, who was playing piano for Eddie Davis, told me that the place was empty. So I talked to this Belak, and I said, let me come in with my band and show you what I can do. And so we were doing some little broadcast for a jewelry firm on Sunday afternoon, Herbert's Blue White Diamonds, which we each received $15 for the hour broadcast. And on that broadcast, I announced that we were going to open at a place called Versailles, 10 East 60th. And, of course, a couple of weeks later when we opened, we jammed it because they all knew that we were going to be there by radio. And after we'd been there a few weeks, we opened at the 81st Street Theater, where I showed Broadway what we could do in the theater. And, of course, we were just such a of course, we'd been broadcasting from the Hi-Ho Club and building up a tremendous backlog of, probably 2 or 3 million radio listeners that wanted to see what the hell we looked like. And when they heard that we were going to play at the theater and they had a chance to see us in the flesh in person, it was a very simple thing to pack the theater. And the opening night at the 81st Street Key Theater, the booker of all the key theaters immediately said, Mr. Valley, will you play all of our key theaters? And like a nitwit, I only asked for $1,500 when I could have got $10,000 or $12,000, but of course I didn't know any better.
Did you use the megaphone, your trademark, at that time?
At that time, there was no amplification of any kind as far as I... The only electrical speakers I ever heard used were in the IBM, the subway trains in New York had little speakers, and some of the cars would say, watch the door, watch the door. And that was the only time I heard a voice being amplified through a speaker. And, of course, in all the broadcasting studios, outside the studio, there were big radios in the hallways where you could hear the program is going on inside the glass-enclosed radio studio. And I said, well, why can't they have a speaker right in the same room with you? They said, because you'll get a feedback. The sound will come out of the speaker and go back into the microphone with your own live voice, and it just won't work out. Because they didn't know that it could work out if you place the speakers in the correct position. And at that time, we had no way of sending the voice forward except to either cup your hands around your mouth or roll up a newspaper or pick up what the cheerleaders have been using for years of football games to send their voices up into the stands and to use the big cheerleader megaphone.
Well, that was the way that developed then. That's very interesting.
Well, it's very obvious. What the hell else could you do?
When did you... start the Fleischman's Hour on radio?
The Fleischman Hour started in October of 1929 and finished in October 1939, 10 years.
It was a long-running show for an early radio program, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right, 52 weeks a year.
No vacation, no rest at all?
No, we didn't need any. It's only once a week. Very easy.
And was your announcer Graham McNamee? I've read that.
He was the first announcer. He was with us about the first 4 or 5 years, and then he died. And then we had several other announcers.
You were really an innovator as far as...
Actually, I did the announcing for the show, that is the program, of the songs and the guests, if we had any guests when we first started. We had one guest when we first started. And then McNamee did the commercials.
Oh, I see.
Did not do the announcing of the show from the standpoint of telling about the songs or the artists who are going to be on the show. That was my job.
I see. You were instrumental in giving radio breaks to a great many people, I understand.
I did not only a great thing for the program more than I, but we did a great deal to introduce a lot of personalities for their first coast-to-coast radio broadcast, Eddie Cantor and all the rest. But also, I think I probably saved the radio itself from going downhill almost into oblivion because it was becoming so damn monotonous with the boring type of programs they were offering, which were pretty bad, that the president of NBC said to me, Mr. Valley, you have demonstrated how powerful radio can be. We're deeply indebted to you. We feel that you have, in a way, saved the National Broadcasting Company.
My goodness, that's quite a tribute.
And then 10 years later, when I sat at a banquet at the Wall of Astoria with Amos Anandi, Graham McNamee, Floyd Gibbons, Fibber McGee and Molly, and all of the great personalities have become great through radio. On my right was the president of NBC, Mr. Sarnoff, who didn't speak to me the entire evening.
He didn't?
Didn't say hello, didn't say anything.
Well, why was that?
I don't know. He's a very peculiar man. Sat on my right next to me, and didn't say hello the entire evening.
No kidding. Didn't the Aldridge family start their broadcasting on your show? Is that right?
That's correct.
Uh-huh. And We the People got started on that program, too.
That I wouldn't remember. I don't think, I'm not sure they started with us at Kate Smith. Kate Smith came along about 1936 with a program to rival ours. All she wanted to do was get one point higher than we did, and then she quit.
Uh-huh.
And she introduced Willie and Eugene Howard, the two comics.
Abbott and Costello.
First, Abbott and Costello. And I'm not sure, but what she took the Aldrich family after we had launched it and then made it a part of her show.
Uh-huh. Well, you talk about the people she introduced. You were involved with introducing Milton Berle and Olson and Johnson, Edgar Bergen, too, right?
That is correct.
Uh-huh. Well, you said that you were on the air once a week with radio. What was Rudy Valling doing the other days of the week in the 30s?
The Brooklyn Paramount, doing 4, 5, and 6 shows a day. 5 and 6 on weekends, 4 shows the normal days of the week. That's including Sunday for a year and a half steadily, the New York or the Brooklyn Paramount Theaters, and also playing what is now the Copacabana, which became the Villa Valley after we changed it from Versailles to Villa Valley, from 12 o'clock until 3 in the morning.
My goodness. Weren't you in the and George White scandals and the vanities, too?
In 2 scandals. No, never in the vanities. 2 scandals, 31 and 36.
Uh-huh, 36. Well, you started doing some things on film then, too, didn't you?
Yes, I made a very bad picture in 1929, RKO, called Vagabond Lover. The picture was so bad that it almost finished my career.
Really? Why was it, why do you say that?
It was just a badly written story, a very bad story, and the director, Marshall Neelan, who had directed some very fine pictures before that, but had never directed anything with a band in it, anything in the nature of a musical. His mother died about halfway through the picture, and he went off on a binge and didn't show up for 2 or 3 weeks. The assistant took over, and the assistant didn't know his rear end from his elbow, and it was just a very bad picture.
Uh-huh. Was that movie made more or less to capitalize on the tag, the Vagabond Lover, that you had?
It was made to show us to rate to the public persons who wanted to see it throughout the country.
Uh-huh.
We'd never seen it.
How did you get that tag, the Vagabond Lover?
I ran across this song when I heard it played in Indianapolis in the fall of 1927, on the summer of 1927, when the Yale Collegians played the Circle Theater in Indianapolis. On a Saturday night, we went to the, there was a room at the top of a hotel there, and we listened to Charlie Davis and his Indiana band, his Hoosier band. It was a marvelous orchestra, all young college boys, and they played beautifully. And one of their boys sang this song, and I found out later that it was more or less considered a song from one of the universities in Indiana, LaSalle, or one of the universities there in Indiana, had used the song. It had been sung around the campus. It originally came from Chicago, from your city.
It did?
Mm-hmm. It turned out later it was written by a lawyer from Chicago, but a young fellow named Leon Zimmerman copyrighted it in 1926 or 27 and said that he wrote it, and after it became quite famous through our record and recordings and broadcasting of it, we were sued by a lawyer named Brown from Chicago, who sued the Victor Company, me, Lizman, and everyone else, RKO included, and we had to pay for lawyers to go to Chicago to convince Brown that we were not the offenders, that the person who had pretended he had written it was Zimmerman. If anyone was fault, he was the person's fault, and to leave us alone to let the song make as much money as it could make for whoever was to receive it. And Brown acceded to that, and eventually it was proven that Brown had really written it, that Zimmerman had not written it.
Well, that's very interesting. Did you appear on... you did, I know, appear on recordings. I want to know how many recordings Rudy Valley sold.
My records never sold very well, and that's why I become a little annoyed today when persons try to tell me what to do when I work in a nightclub or on the spot, and when they insist that I do more singing.
Uh-huh.
It's very embarrassing to me to have to tell them that my singing never really meant very much.
It was the
wasn't my singing that was the main portion of success in 1920 and 1929. It was the way the band played as I asked them to play, what we played, the way I talked about the songs, and the odd name and the picturization of what I must look like physically.
Mm-hmm.
And although I did sing fairly simply and pleasantly with a very thin voice, somewhat nasal, it was not really comparable to the recording quality that Crosby had. Uh-huh. And when I heard Crosby's first recordings, I knew that he was just going to kick me so far out of the picture that it wasn't even funny, which, of course, he did, because his record sold into the millions, whereas mine very rarely sold. Mm-hmm. And a matter of fact, in the last 8 or 10 years, all attempts at LPs of recordings of songs, old and new, have met with dismal failure. And so I just have to tell my very eager friends that they're, unfortunately, they're in a very tiny minority, as both of your listeners are.
Well, that's my two listeners, and you and I enjoy your music, I'll tell you that.
Well,
Mr. Valley, after you more or less closed on the Fleischman's Hour, you moved right into the Seal Test Hour on radio.
Not much later, 1940, March of 1940, yes.
And didn't you do that program with John Barrymore?
It didn't start with Barrymore. It started with a format that was written by Paul Henning, who created the Beverly Hillbillies, Green Acres, and Petticoat Junction.
Uh-huh.
Henning at that time conceived the idea of taking historical figures such as Christopher Columbus, Captain John Smith, and so forth, and in 27 minutes doing a little operetta with two or three songs to be sung by me or the King's Men, a group of four male singers, and using Mary Boland as Queen Isabella for me to portray Christopher Columbus. And the way this was done was to somehow get into a dream sequence in which I would dream the operetta. Having been reading a book on Christopher Columbus up to the time that Slapsy Maxey, who was a steady feature in the show, somehow I would either fall from a ladder or Slapsy would sock me in the jaw accidentally in training or sparring.
Uh-huh.
And the book that I'd been reading would be the mainstream of the little 26 minutes of the story, the operetta. And it started off with a rating of 17, which is a fairly good rating, in March of 1940, and went down to a summer of 4, rating of 4.
Uh-huh.
As we went east for the summer, so that I could go to my lodge in Maine, they threw Slapsy out the window, threw Vic Knight, who was directing it, out the window. They kept Paul Henning on, and then said to me, will you pick from the list of 6 or 7 directors we've given you a man you think can pull this show out of the abyss in which it has gone? I picked Ed Gardner, who later on became Archie of Duffy's Tavern,
mm-hmm.
because I'd worked with Gardner on my Fleischman Hour when he substituted for several weeks in 1936 and 35. And I knew that although he was a very difficult person, he was a very gifted and a very talented person in writing and in direction. He took the show from a low of 4. And it is his idea, not mine, to use Barrymore, whom he has used on the Texaco show when he directed the Texaco show before I did the Seal Test show.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of the use of Barrymore, the show rose from September 1940 from a low of 4 to a rating of 25.
It's amazing.
He was really a blessing. He was just a tremendous shot in the arm and made the show truly great.
How long did that show last?
I'm writers for $250 each that you couldn't buy today for $5,000 and $10,000 for a script.
Yeah.
We had not only Ed Gardner supervising all the writers, because he was essentially a writer more than he was a director.
Mm-hmm.
Under him, he got Abe Burrows for $350 a week. Henning was still only getting $250 a week. We had Panama and Frank, $250 each. We had Jess Oppenheimer, who created I Love Lucy, mm-hmm. for $250. We had Charles Isaacs, Chuck Isaacs, who used to do the Skelton Show up to a year or so ago for $250 a week, Keith Fowler, and we had some of the greatest writers that ever wrote for radio.
Well, that's amazing.
Peanuts.
That must have been one of the key reasons why that show was so...
That's why those scripts are so great.
Yeah. Do you have any of those scripts yet?
I have every one of those scripts, and I have all the acetate discs of them.
Have you?
I have all of them.
How can we get a copy of those from you?
No problem.
No problem.
No.
Good. I'm going to write you.
No.
Rudy Valley, you were in the Coast Guard during World War II.
In the Navy in World War I at the age of 15. They discovered I'd lied about my age and sent me back to school, for which I'm very, very grateful. And then in 1942, I enlisted in the Coast Guard as a Chief Petty Officer Bandmaster with an orchestra of 18 men that I built to 47.
Uh-huh.
one of the finest musical outfits out on the coast, and I came out of the war as a lieutenant senior grade.
You were a bandmaster at one time?
Yes, all my experience in the Coast Guard was as a bandmaster.
Uh-huh. They couldn't have gotten a more perfect bandmaster for the Coast Guard.
Well, there was an 18-piece outfit down at Long Beach that had been put together by a yachtsman named Max Sturges, who had played with Benny Pollock's orchestra, played saxophone with Benny Pollock's orchestra, and he was one of my great admirers. He was a great fan of Rudy Vallon. He told the girl who was my secretary that he would like me to lead this 18-piece band, which was exactly what I wanted to do because I couldn't get a commission in the Navy. I couldn't get a commission in the Air Force, and I was damned if I was going in as a private. With my college education and my experience in the world and show business, I felt I was entitled to at least a first lieutenant in something. And so he said, I'd like you to lead this 18-piece band, and I would have gone in as a commissioned officer, but that little dido that Tony Martin pulled in San Francisco, where he gave a lieutenant commander an automobile to get a commission of ensign, sort of made it tough for anybody in show business to be commissioned. So the smartest thing for all of us, I said to all these officers that I was at a banquet one night when they discussed the idea of my becoming the band leader, I said, gentlemen, I know how embarrassed you are, because if you give me a commission, everyone's going to ask you, what the hell did the Valley give you for it? The way Tony Martin did, and I said, gentlemen, to save you that embarrassment, I'll go in as a non-commissioned man, the chief petty officer, and after a year or so, you can jump me to gold braid, which they did.
Well, it worked out fine for you, then.
Very nicely.
After the war, was there any radio programs that you hosted or starred upon?
On to the Dream program for Procter & Gamble.
Uh-huh.
2 years with them, the most money I ever made in radio. Couldn't keep any of it, but I at least went on with them for 2 years, and we were on at a rather bad time at 10 o'clock in the east, and we got a rating of, I think, no more than 11. They were paying me 13.5 and 14.5, out of which I paid the other guests in the band. And you're supposed to get $1,000 per point, and 11 rating didn't give me the didn't justify their expense. They offered me the third year if I would let Carlton Alsop direct it, would I come on and stay on for $5,000? And I said, gentlemen, you can have it, because I had no respect for Carlton Alsop. Who took the show over was Don Ameche to replace me, and each week they were to present a famous film actress in one of the best scenes for one of her best pictures. And they also brought Jim Backus from Chicago to be the voice of Hubert, what
Updike.
Is his name, Hubert something?
Hubert Updike.
Updike, that's right. And that's where he began out here in radio, on that program that I turned down for the third year. And they also took Pinky Lee, whom I had developed in the second year of the Dream program, to $1,000 a week, from $100 to $1,000, and had also given him practically the entire show. And instead of his sticking with me in the hopes that we would get a show and we could continue to work together, because we were very good together, I was very good as a straight man, feeding man for him, because I subordinated myself to him, and I was the contrast between my quality and class and diction and his way of doing comedy was a perfect welding of two personalities. And if he'd been smart, he'd have stayed with me. And I said, you little Jew boy, they're wanting to dine you simply because they think you're going to be good on the show. But Amici said, I won't work with that little burlesque comic. He said, to hell with him. And so after about 8 or 10 shows, they dropped Pinky, and they paid him off for 40 full weeks. But he was dropped, and I said, Pinky, you loused me up, because I couldn't get the program I wanted because I didn't have a good running mate. And they dropped Pinky, and the show never got above, I think it about stayed about where it was with me, about 11, and they dropped at the end of the third year.
You've always had to be concerned with ratings on radio, just as television is today.
I can remember the first time, which was in 1931, that I was on a tour of Karma Public Theaters, starting first in Boston, where they threw the grapefruit, then down to Miami, where I played the Olympia Theater, then to New Orleans, where I played the Sanger Theater, doing the Mardi Gras. And it was there at that theater that I noticed this fellow always seated in the audience, particularly in the balcony. And he came backstage one day to talk to me, and I said, what are you doing? He said, J. Walter Thompson has asked me to watch the reaction of the audiences here in the theater and to get an idea of what your popularity on radio has done for you in the theater, etc. In other words, he was the first to sort of get a finger on the pulse of what I was doing in a way of reaching human beings.
Uh-huh.
And up to that time, there had been no such thing as a rating. Suddenly, there it was. You had the first thing, of course, was Crosley.
Yes.
Before the Hooper came in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And before the Nielsen came in. First it was Crosley, then Hooper, then Nielsen.
Did you... you appeared in a few films after the war, too. I mean, Bachelor in the Bobby Soxer and Gentleman Married.
The best thing I ever made was made just at the beginning of the war in 1942 at Paramount, the Palm Beach Story for Preston Sturges.
I think is
not only a damn good film, but the best thing I ever did.
Mm-hmm. You had a dramatic role in that.
It's more of a humorous role.
Well, I mean, as opposed to being just cast as a singer.
Oh, well, there was no brand, except for one little song at the end, which is supposed to bring Colbert to me, but only pushed her back in the arms of her husband. With the exception of that one little song, I was not, in any sense of the word, I was the world's wealthiest man. Mr. John D. Hackensacker III. In other words, John D. Rockefeller III. And in no sense of the word was I cast as anything to do with show business or a singer.
Well, most recently, I think, in films, we saw you in How to Succeed in Business, recreating your stage role.
Yes, the film wasn't as good as the stage show. The stage show in New York was much better.
If you didn't get to see Rudy Vallee on the stage, though,
Rudy... was a dear, very dear man, and a man to whom I'm deeply indebted. I would not have been in the picture had not David Swift been producer and director. But he wanted me for a previous Columbia picture, Good Neighbor Sam. And I knew that when David Swift was given the role of director and producer of How to Succeed film for United Artists, I had a pretty good chance of getting it. And if he hadn't been producer-director, I never would have gotten it. I think they would have given it to Milton Berle or Crosby or somebody like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rudy Vallee, I really appreciate your taking the time this afternoon to talk with us and
you're welcome.
To reminisce a little bit about your career. And we're looking forward to seeing you out at the Vaudeville Follies of 1971 at the Erie Crown Theater on October 9th.
Well, I imagine I'll be a bit of a shock to some persons. I simply say to those who are coming that night, who have any desire to see me, don't come with any preconceived notions of what I will do or what I should do, because I'm going to do what I want to do, and it probably won't be what you expect me to do, and you may not like it, so I say screw.
Well, we think that you have a fantastic following out here, and the same two people who are listening to us today are going to be watching you on Howard Miller's show on the night before.
One of the two comes, at least we'll have one person in the audience.
Thank you, Rudy Vallee, for reminiscing with us today on Those Were the Days.